The following program is produced and furnished in conjunction with Mark Amtower of Amtower & Company, which is entirely responsible for its content.
This is Amtower Off-Center, sponsored by General Dynamics Information Technology. Every week, author, speaker, consultant Mark Amtower gives you his take on what's going on in the world of government contracting. Amtower Off-Center, with your host, Mark Amtower.
Welcome to Amtower Off-Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Mark Amtower. My guest today is Larry Allen of Allen Federal. If you don't know Larry, you probably haven't been in the market too long. Larry, welcome back to the show.
Mark, thanks for having me. Great to be here as always.
Love the visitor's badge. You aren't a visitor, man. You're a resident.
I just say, so long as I come here, I'm always just a visitor. I can't get a security clearance for the station.
Somehow I did. I don't know. Maybe the 60s don't exist like I remember, but all right, let's look at the pending FY16 scenario here. Give me your 50,000 foot view, and then let's take a deeper dive into particular issues.
Now the top level view, Mark, for FY16 is it'll start slowly. But I think there's reason to be cautiously optimistic, particularly if you're a contractor that does a lot of DOD business. And we can talk about that more. But I think that there's a reason to believe that there'll be a little bit more discretionary spending overall in FY16 than there has been this year. And that may be particularly the case in FY16. We're not going to have a bonanza year, so it's not returning the days of the Wild West. But in terms of an incremental improvement, I think that we're going to be better off certainly than we were a couple of years ago.
I don't think we're ever going back to what we had in the 90s. It was a lot of fun while it was here, right?
Yes, so, it was.
So there you go. All right. Well, let's take a little deeper dive into the DOD scenario. I was under the impression that the sequestration spending or lack of spending, the squeeze, was going to impact a little more, particularly on DOD and FY16. Is that not accurate?
Well, I think that it's not going to turn out to be accurate because of congressional maneuvering. Congress has, for many years, had a contingency budget for overseas operations for DOD. When we had a lot of overseas operations, they went to fund. Those funds went to fund our activity in Afghanistan and Iraq. Even though we're not doing much in Afghanistan and Iraq, Congress still kept the contingency funding, known by the shorthand as OCO, Overseas Contingency Operations. Why? Because OCO money is off budget, and it doesn't count against the sequestration cap limits. So what we're seeing right now is a Congress that wants to put extra DOD money in that contingency budget that really, Mark, may only be somewhat related to overseas contingency. Really what it is it's a maneuver to put more money in that account that would keep it immune from any spending cuts and give DOD more money to meet their mission.
Okay. Now, do you anticipate more DOD mission over there as the result of ISIS activity?
Well, I think that that's certainly a possibility. It's always a wild card, Mark. Mm-hmm. Sometimes events dictate our actions, not the other way around. The United States likes to think that our actions dictate events. That's not always the case.
In recent years, not ever the case, right?
If we do see some activity, then, of course, the funding will be there for overseas operations. I think, actually, in that case, Congress would come back at the time and say, look, we actually need to bring more money into the DOD budget to support actual operations, because in reality, the money that goes now into the OCO budget is going to be spoken for other projects.
Okay. So what's next on the agenda here? The cloud adoption. I heard that DOD is putting out an RFI for looking for a cloud supplier for 4.3 million email accounts. So is the cloud going to be used for more than email ever?
That's a very good question. I think we're starting to see it be used for more things, Mark. I think we're starting to see storage being a cloud function. The future for cloud is also, I think, going to include things like telecommunications solutions that has the potential to really disrupt some of the traditional players in the telecom market. But the big reason I put this on my list of things for FY16 is because I think FY15, the current fiscal year, is one that we really started to see cloud finally achieve a federal market beachhead. And FY16 is when I think that beachhead is going to expand out into more agencies for more functions. In the commercial market, if you're listening to this show and you're in the commercial market, this is going to sound like we maybe did this show in 2011. But in reality, the federal government is a lagger in terms of adopting newer technologies. Cloud is no exception to that. We've talked about cloud for an awfully long time in the federal market, but we actually haven't done a lot. Well, that started to change in FY15, and I think it's going to just get bigger in FY16 and further out.
Well, you know, the I want to be third mentality plays here very big because the cloud is a huge thing, and a lot of agencies really don't want to be on that bleeding edge. They don't want to be the one who's embarrassed by doing something that backfires, so they wait.
Boy, that really came home at an industry event I attended recently, Mark, where there were three federal CIOs and one chief technology officer. And the overwhelming theme that came out of that discussion was just what you implied, is a real built-in aversion to risk. There is no benefit for our CIOs and CTOs to take risk because they don't feel that they have top cover from their senior management in their agencies. And so while you see innovation in certain places, GSA's 18F, HHS has an innovative acquisition place, and you're starting to see NIH start up an innovative acquisition lab as well.
I think they've NITAC's actually had that for a couple of years now.
Right. But innovation is limited to, I think, smaller projects, which I think favors smaller companies. However, overall, you're exactly right. The government has no problem being third in terms of being the third wave of people that adopt IT solutions. The risk-reward paradigm inside the federal government is substantially different from it is in the commercial sector. And our CIOs feel that if they take a risk and the mistakes are made, then that's a career ender for them. When no one in the mahogany wing of the agency will have their back. It's very telling.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, the CIOs are appointees too. So if they want to vacate the premises, they're more than, you know, willing to do so. And maybe they'll do like JJ did and hire a cloud company and then go to work for them. won't say who JJ was, Joe, but not that I have any opinions. I agree that the I want to be third mentality has been with us for a long time, and it's because of the risk-averse nature of the beast. The only time you get called up before Congress is not to be patted on the back for doing something right. It is when anything minor that can be played as big hits the fan.
Well, that's exactly right. And I think that that's feeding into that mentality. And it's no wonder then that you have something on the order of 75 or 80% of all IT funds being purposed to maintain existing systems. Even in some cases, when those existing systems are written in COBOL And literally the only people who know how to program those are
buried
or 75 or 80 year old retired annuitants who keep having to be bought back to update the code.
Yeah.
This is no way to run a government.
No, it is no way to run a government. You are listening to AmTower Off Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm here with Larry Allen. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to AmTower Off Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I am Mark AmTower. My guest is Larry Allen of Allen Federal. You can find Larry at Allen, A-L-L-E-N, federal.com. Sign up for his newsletter. It comes out Monday morning. It's three topics and sometimes commercial, but the three topics are always dead on for things that are really in front of us right now. And we're actually probably going to reach those a little later on in the show for topics that popped up this week. But we were just talking a little bit about the innovative procurement activities. What do you think of 18F?
Mark, I kind of like 18F. And when 18F, GSA's Innovative Acquisition Lab, was first stood up, I have to admit I was skeptical for a variety of reasons. But
well, we're always skeptical.
Well, when Washington,
it's our job.
Washingtonians, a cynical lot by nature. But 18F has kind of really impressed me. They've done mainly small acquisitions, small projects. But what I've been told is that they now have more agencies coming to them to help with innovation than they can handle. So that's a good sign. So much so that other agencies are considering setting up similar operations to 18F. So, you know, nothing gets more copycat activity like a successful operation.
Right.
So, you know, good stuff, good innovation, mostly small things, but not entirely small. Now that 18F's been around for a while and people see that they can get things done quickly, you have a lot of bigger players coming to them trying to suggest that the procurement they're working on with a customer agency is great for the 18F channel. Mm-hmm. And I think therein, that's part of the risk. If you get too far afield from your original mission, you get to the point where you try something really innovative on a larger scale and it doesn't work out so well. No matter what your charter says, that could get you some unwelcome oversight.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
If you're doing a smaller innovative project that really is within your initial focus area and that doesn't work out well, you know, you can write that up and learn from the experience, and people probably wouldn't get too upset about that. After all, that's what you're supposed to do.
Right.
But my concern is that the success and popularity of 18F may lead to some mission creep, and that's where you could have some other problems come into play.
Yeah, and as I mentioned, you know, Rob Cohn's group over at NITAC has their assisted acquisition shop, but it's not necessarily, or it's not meant to be, an innovative shop. You know, when agencies need help on procurement, they'll say this is the type of vehicle that's going to be best for what you're trying to
right.
do here, and we can help you do it. So, one of the things that is never going to leave us ever again, and it's been with us forever, but it hadn't had funding forever, is that cyber issue.
Well, cybersecurity and its many manifestations, Mark, continue to be the first, second, and third priorities of most federal IT people. And as you mentioned, it hasn't always gotten the funding. Right now, I'm not sure that anybody would say there could be enough funding given all of the headlines that we have about data breaches and hacks here and websites taken offline over there. And so it's a huge issue and one with profound implications, not just for today, but for years to come based on hacks that have already happened. So even if we were successful in implementing a system that mitigated future activity, we still have to have a robust cyber system in place to monitor out-year activity 3, 5, 10 years down the road for things that have already taken place. I'm not sure that everybody fully understands that You know, not every cyber hack that takes place in 2015 is meant to have the data used in 2015. It could be used in 2020.
Right.
So you got to pay attention to that. But I think that cyber is going to continue to dominate. It is getting more money now. Even as it gets more money, we're starting to see how cyber dollars are spent change a little bit, getting into things like predictive analytics so that we can put systems in place that will predict behavior of people or organizations better as a way to get out in front of any potential future problems. We've already seen at the state and local level sensor technology for police officers. We know that DOD Secretary Ashton Carter was recently in Silicon Valley, and they awarded a big grant to a company there for sensor technology to put sensors on active duty frontline military soldiers. So I think sensor technology has many uses. One of them is in the cyber world, whether it's threat detection or some sort of mitigation. There is literally almost no limit to how cyber dollars can be spent. I think the key is to ensure that we're spending them wisely and we're not just spending them in reactive mode at a tactical level, that we actually begin to develop a strategy that allows us to prevent but also to monitor, you know, over time things that have already taken place.
Yeah, and you know, again, there's a lot of issues in the cyber threat arena. So we'll leave that at that. You also think that small companies are going to have a really good chance at being involved in the innovative side of things in government moving forward, starting 2016. Why?
Well, I think we've talked already in the show today about the risk-averse nature of federal acquisition, particularly in technology. Where you're seeing risk being accepted and encouraged is typically on smaller or not ready for full production.
Not ready for prime time.
Yeah, right, exactly. Not ready for full production products, which are typically coming from smaller or more innovative suppliers. So if we know that you have a risk-averse federal market that would like to be innovative but not on a big scale, that lines itself up greatly for small businesses that have really innovative ideas to come in. Similarly, when you have the Department of Defense in particular, not exclusively, but in particular, saying we want non-traditional companies to come in and show us their best and brightest futuristic products, futuristic solutions, that's going to bring in a lot of smaller startup type companies as well. And not only does that feed in nicely to the government's mandate to make maximum use of small businesses, always a perceived socioeconomic goal and benefit, but it really gives the government the opportunity to try things that may be a little risky, that if they fail, don't cause catastrophic problems. If they succeed, they can be replicated or actually bought into full-scale production, and everybody benefits.
Okay. We only have a couple of minutes left in this segment, but we're going to start this and continue it in the next segment. The rise of the GWACs. GSA schedules are losing ground, basically, and there's a fair amount of confusion on the vendor part, particularly as a GSA continues to apply, although I haven't seen it lately, the strategic sourcing initiative to other schedules. I'm assuming that's still in the queue, but we have NITAC with three GWACs totaling a potential $60 billion. We have SOUP with another $20 billion. They, you know, from all of the reports I've heard, those vehicles are doing very well end of FY 2015 and will continue to build momentum going forward. What's going on here?
Well, I think what we're seeing here is customers and contractors, frankly, voting with their feet is something that I've been predicting for a while. If you make a program too difficult for people to use, they'll stop using it and they'll move to other alternatives, particularly if they're ready-made alternatives. And we're talking here about IT and, to a certain extent, professional services. I think an interesting discussion to be
had. Well, CIOCS is services.
Right. So it'd be interesting to see what the discussion would be like if you're talking about furniture, scientific equipment, other things that the schedules do and do on a government-wide basis that really no other agency does.
Yeah, or should.
Or right. And yet they might. But, you know, what you're seeing here, look, Soup 5 has always been, the Soup program generally has always been lauded for its ease of use, its great customer service, the fact that the NASA people work very hard, not just with federal customers, but with contractors to conduct good and timely procurements that are within the scope of the Soup contract and that really meet the needs of the customer. Similarly, NIH has developed that reputation as well.
Yeah, Steve Cooper loves SP.
Well, right, and I think you're seeing NIH really kind of spread its wings and become more of an open challenger to NASA, which makes things makes life interesting in the Cohen household.
But that's an inside joke,
right? But nevertheless, I mean, this is good for customers too, because if you've got Soup, if you've got NIH's vehicles, you also have things at GSA that work reasonably well, like Alliant and Oasis.
Yep, yep.
And those are the contracts and vehicles that are getting all of the attention inside GSA.
Right. And Alliant's getting ready for
Alliant
round
two. Alliant 2, and that's going to be coming out in 2016. We've already heard a few things about how it's going to be structured. It's going to look in some ways.
Casey, you'll be back on the show before the RFP goes out.
Right. It's going to look in some ways an awful lot like Oasis, the Oasis RFP looked like in terms of what GSA's hoping to see out of bidders. But, you know, what you're seeing is, look, these are contract vehicles that offer widespread ease of use. They offer exceptional customer service. And they offer contractors the ability to quickly update their contracts without going through a lengthy modification process. Whereas on the schedules, anything you want to load up on the schedules in terms of regulatory burden seems to be what GSA is doing. That's in vogue.
Okay. Hold that thought a second. We need to take a break. You're listening to AmTower Off Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to AmTower Off Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm here with Larry Allen. We're discussing the GWACs, the GSA schedule, and
all of the regulatory burdens that GSA is loading up on its one-time flagship program, the multiple award schedules. Now, Mark, I'm a big advocate, as you know, of the schedules program. I kind of cut my teeth on the schedules program.
Only 19 years.
coming up with it, and I still think that properly run and used, the schedules program is a great vehicle. But, you know, we talked a little bit before about strategic sourcing, and now that's kind of morphed into the hallways program that GSA is putting forth, all of which is based on reducing the number of companies on contract and making sure that the companies that remain on contract are low price leaders, with, as far as I can see, not a terrible amount of attention given to quality or capability of those companies. Similarly, GSA is, make no mistake, they're going to implement their transactional data proposed rule. It was proposed merely to give people an opportunity to talk about it, but don't think that it's going to, that the comment period is going to stop GSA from doing this. I've been told by people inside the agency that we will have a transactional data collection construct. It's just a question of
when. And the onus is on?
Onus, as always, is going to be on contractors to set up and collect data and then transmit it to the government.
So we want to reduce your margins and increase your workload to further erode profitability.
So it shouldn't be any surprise that contractors have said, look, if I've got a credible alternative in another GWAC or MAC program, I'm going to be using that program more than I'm going to be using my schedule. We don't see NASA trying to load me up with transactional data constructs. We don't see NIH coming after me for always being the strictly lowest priced company out there. There's some admission of value there. So companies are voting with their feet, their business feet, and customers as well. I mean, there's a time and place for getting the low cost alternative, but that time and place is not in all situations. GSA's management, however, seems to believe that the schedules program should be the low cost leader. And
well, they're supposed to negotiate that on the front end, not go back in and impose stuff after the contract's in place.
Therein lies one of the interesting things. In the rules right now, if anybody bothers to look at the ordering rules say customer agencies should always seek a discount so that they're encouraged to seek discounts at the transaction level. GSA needs to figure out what it wants. Does it want a low price at the contract level where no spot discounts are available? Or does it want to have a reasonable contract level price where spot discounts are available in competitive situations? Because you're not going to be able to have both. And if you have a customer that's used to negotiating a spot discount on schedule for 10, 15% below the schedule price, and you've taken that 10 or 15% out of the contract level, you're going to have some explaining to do. And not just some explaining to do, you're going to have some ordering rules that need to be rewritten to reflect your change in emphasis.
Well, how many pages is a FAR these days?
Yeah, it's more than it probably should be. But my point is, how many people are really going to go through that exercise, Mark, if unless they absolutely have to? So if there's no market, no government-wide acquisition contract or MAC alternative to the schedules, those are the only people that are really going to have to go through that exercise. If you've got credible alternatives, you're going to be using those. Herein, by the way, is a cautionary tale for our friends at DISA, who are proceeding along with Encore 2 being a low-price, technically acceptable contract, notwithstanding the fact that the current Encore contract has done some fairly sophisticated national security-related work.
I always want that being low-price.
Right, well, of course. So, you know, the DISA people need to understand that it's fine if they want to make it low price. That's their prerogative, but it doesn't mean that everybody's going to use them. Their customers who want sophisticated national security work done, as you point out, are probably not going to go to a no-name, low-price company to get it done. They'll find another way from a credible company to have that need fulfilled.
One would have assumed that DISA would have had somewhat a broader bandwidth on the front end of this to avoid a pure LPTA play.
Well, and this is kind of the reaction that I'm getting from the people in industry, Mark, is DISA had reasonably good relationships with the companies on the current Encore contract.
Mm-hmm.
Current Encore has worked well. The communication lines were open. I think industry was kind of blindsided by the LPTA pronouncement, wondering, you know, what the partnership was about and whether or not they could continue to do business on Encore 2 if it goes forward as an LPTA vehicle.
That's a frightening proposition.
Well, it's a frightening proposition if you're DISA, if you're a company, if you're an agency that runs another MAC or GWAC contract that has a similar scope and allows for good value procurements. This is your opportunity to potentially pick up business.
I can think of a few previously mentioned on this show just a few minutes ago.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about the tendency of appointees to flee the sinking ship immediately prior to the dunking, shall we say.
So. Well, right. We're currently in year 7 of an 8-year presidency. We're almost on the effective dawn of year 8 with the presidential elections just about a year out. And what you see inevitably at this stage of any administration is more and more political appointees thanking the president for the opportunity to be in national service and then leaving to go out and do the next thing. We're going to see an awful lot of appointees, both the ones at senior levels and the ones that don't make the national news, but nevertheless have been very important to getting things done in their own agencies, leaving. We're going to see, this is always the time when I think it would be great to have an equity card, because you're going to have an awful lot of people who are in an acting capacity.
Yep.
My terrible joke, sorry.
Well, that's okay. Yeah.
But so,
yeah.
and while the people who come in an acting capacity are usually good people, they're usually the senior careerists who come in every time we're in this type of situation. The fact is that if an agency was moving in fourth or fifth gear with a priority that was pushed and championed by an appointee, and that appointee leaves, no matter how much the acting person might agree with that philosophy, inevitably we drop down to what I think is the equivalent of third gear. We're moving forward, but we're not moving forward nearly as fast as we were, and we're going to see more business as usual type things where you're moving forward, but you're not moving forward briskly because you don't want to move so far afield that the next round of appointees that come in a little over a year totally scrap what you've been working on and move in an entirely different direction.
Ooh, I have a great idea.
That's right.
What do we do here?
Well, that's right. That's so, you know, you're going to see that. It's troubling when you see things that you like that suddenly stop moving forward.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, Mark, this is also the time of year if there are programs that are championed by political appointees that rank and file government employees don't like, contractors may be ambivalent about. We go into the government contracting version of the Four Corners offense. People who remembered
Dean Smith
basketball life before the shot clock. So, you know, the idea is to pass the ball around and not really go towards the hoop and let the clock run down so that
game of attrition.
The game is over before you've actually gotten a chance to finish it. So, and we see that a lot too. Every time we get into year 7 or 8 of a presidential administration, that's why I think that, except for some of the executive orders coming out of the White House, there's probably little need to be apoplectic about any drastic new program that is coming forth at this stage, because simply put, there isn't enough time to get anywhere with it.
Point. All right, we're going to take a break. You're listening to Amtower Off-Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Mark Amtower, back with Larry after these messages. Welcome back to Amtower Off-Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. My guest is Larry Allen. Once again, you can find Larry on LinkedIn and at allenfederal.com, allenfederal.com. Larry, one of your recent newsletters was... caught my attention immediately because it started talking about relationships. I'm huge on this in this market. But why did that pop out in this particular newsletter? What prompted it?
Well, I think we're getting caught up right now, Mark, in what's going to be going on in FY16 and what's going to be new and different and exciting. And that's always important. We also need to keep in mind that there are touchstones that you need to be aware of as a government contractor that are timeless. Regardless of what fiscal year you're in, there are things that you need to have as real cornerstones of a successful federal business, and that's what I was writing about. So, you know, the first one I put down is that process is important, but relationships are paramount. People are really traditionally good at process or relationships. Both are important. But what caught my attention about this particular issue, Mark, was I was recently in a meeting with a group of mostly retired, very senior level government acquisition executives. Collectively, their knowledge of the federal acquisition regulations would make your head explode. And yet, after about a 5-minute discussion on process, even these big heads got together and were talking about the importance of relationships, about the importance of being able to make a person-to-person connection between government and industry. And for these people, the knowledge of process was a given. We can do a whole show on whether that's actually appropriate. But to these people, they're like, look, if you're serious about doing government business, we're going to assume that you understand the process at least to a point. And what you really need to focus on is building the relationships with customers and with other contractors that can help you grow your business. And I think they're dead on, accurate, and I think they're absolutely right. I thought it was particularly notable coming from a bunch of regulatory experts. The second thing I thought about is you and I both deal a lot with commercial companies, and these commercial companies may or may not do a lot of business in the federal market. And get some new market entries or some market entries who want to change how they're doing business in the market. No matter how big a deal you are commercially, if your brand name has no federal presence, that's going to hurt you. And you can't assume just because your brand name is well known in the commercial market that it's going to resonate with people in government. You need to take the time to establish your brand and your presence in the federal market. Why? Because the competitors that you're doing business with have already taken those steps. They're established. They're known. They've done what I just mentioned in number one, which is develop the relationships that helps establish the brand. So your commercial reputation doesn't necessarily precede you when you're going into the federal market, unless something nasty and bad has just happened to your company. So if the CEO of your company has just been hauled off or fired because they gave a preferential flight route to somebody who had a vacation home in South Carolina, that could be a problem. Not that that would ever happen.
No.
But so there's no upside to having a good commercial reputation if you don't have an established federal brand. Conversely, there's downside if your commercial brand has been tarnished. Life's not fair, but this is the fact.
Well, you also have the downside if your commercial brand is known as a consumer product, not a business product. You know, it's kind of hard to transition over.
That's very true. It's hard. And if you are seen as a commercial product, not a business product, you're going to have a lot of skepticism. We talked at the top of this show about government buyers being risk averse. This is another place where that manifests itself.
Right. If Sears were going to get back into the government market, they probably wouldn't lead with Kenmore.
Right. You'd lead with your integrated services, but that's another story. The third thing I think that is timeless that people need to be focusing on is, look, just as people in your own contractor organization leave, retire, or get promoted, so too do feds. You alluded to the fact that I ran a trade association for a long, long time. And one of the things I learned is if you want to keep members, we had corporate members in the coalition, you'd better have at least 2 points of contact for every member company, because at some point, John Smith is going to retire or get promoted, and if John was your only contact for that coalition member, the chances of you being able to renew that member were slim. And I use that as an example, but it's an example that holds true in any type of government business. If you have a good relationship in DLA with one person, and suddenly that person in DLA gets transferred, you're starting from square one at DLA, and other people, maybe your competitors, have existing relationships with the person who's still there. was maybe sitting in the next chair over, and now they're responsible for managing the product or service you had before with the person you had a good relationship with. So it pays to get to know multiple people inside the same organization, whether they're contracting people, whether they're finance people, program managers, or what have you. Make sure your relationships run deep.
The relationships are critical. They are, you know, they are the A of the ABCs. So let's wrap up here. Three things contractors need to watch out for in 2016 and beyond.
So for 2016, Mark, I think, as we alluded to earlier, we're going to see continuing rise in GWAC and MAC use, not all at the expense of the GSA schedules program. Some of it will be. So contracts like Soup, Alliant, Oasis, just to name three, some of the NIH vehicles. Simply put, if you're selling IT and professional services in the government, you have to have at least one of these indefinite delivery, indefinite quantity vehicles.
Two would be nice.
Two would be nice. If you're in IT, for example, some estimates are that as much as 50% of the spend goes through these vehicles. So if you're not on them, or if you don't have a partnership with somebody who is on them, you're giving away 50% of your market right off the top, and nobody really wants to do that. The second thing that I think is important to know is we talk a lot about relationships here. Relationships are great and everybody is happy, you and your government customer, so long as everything's going well. If there's a problem, don't expect your government partner to continue being your government partner. It's kind of like Casablanca. They will be shocked to find that gambling has been going on
at Rick's,
at Rick's Cafe, and you are the gambler at Rick's. Contractors are always the lowest rung on the ladder. Don't ever forget that. You, as the contractor, are the convenient scapegoat. And be aware, that partnership is good, but it has its limitations. The third thing, I think, for FY16 is there are going to, by and large, be better opportunities for business, particularly in DOD, better than certainly FY14, I think somewhat better than FY15. It does not mean that opportunities are going to be falling off trees. You're still going to have to go out and look for them. And there are still going to be federal agencies that are under a rather austere method of operation. However, there will be plenty of fruit to pick in FY16. You just have to know where to go to pick it.
There you go. Larry, thanks so much for joining me today. If you haven't noticed, this is not my day job. My Government Market Master Continuing Professional Education Program is the best source for B2G marketing training. There are 6 4-hour workshops. These offer a comprehensive dive into what's working in the GovCon marketing, predicated on my unparalleled 30 years experience in marketing to the government. Full details on my blog at federaldirect.net. And thank you very much for listening to AmTower Off Center.
You've been listening to AmTower Off Center, sponsored by General Dynamics Information Technology. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. AmTower Off Center, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.